Dr. Andy Bannister, director and lead apologist for RZIM Canada, stresses the importance of effective communication that engages the heart and shares the three-level apologetic approach used by the apologists from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. This lecture was given on February 20, 2016, to the C.S. Lewis Fellows of Chicago at the historic Moody Church in downtown Chicago.
So in terms of communication, I mean, I think obviously evangelism is about communication, apologetics is about communication. We, you know, believe in Christ and follow him, want to communicate that faith to others. But as somebody once said, of course, the biggest problem when it comes to communication is the assumption that it's occurred. And one of the things I've noticed across the years that's interesting, I don't know if you've spotted this as well, you know, you can be an amazing scholar. You can be somebody who has the best arguments and the most brilliant mind, and we can probably all think of our favorite Christian theologians, and you can write or communicate really badly, and you could have minimal influence. But on the other hand, you can be a moderate or average scholar or communicator, write brilliantly, and have a huge influence. And because communication, you know, in some ways is everything. I noticed this when I first began studying the New Atheists, that the New Atheists, Dawkins, Harris, Hitchens, all the rest, their arguments are appalling. I mean, really bad arguments, not just slightly bad, sophomorically bad, laughably bad in many places, but they write brilliantly. I mean, Dawkins is an incredible writer, if you've ever read any of his works. Sam Harris, the same. Christopher Hitchens, you know, an incredible loss, sadly, in many ways to journalism when he died 3 years ago of cancer. He was a brilliant writer, incredible essayist. You read his stuff and you're like, I agree with you. I don't care what you're saying. You have to be right because it's just so well written. And this is really, really important. And I've seen this also as an apologist and evangelist as well, that you can have the best arguments in the world, but unless you can communicate clearly and engage the person you're talking to, it's all for nothing. And maybe if you're like me, you've had that experience of trying to share your faith with somebody. Maybe you use a little bit of apologetics jujitsu that you learned at the C.S. Lewis Institute or wherever, you know, your favorite little apologetic argument, and you use it on your atheist friend, and it really is like water off a duck's back. It goes ping, and there's absolutely no engagement. You think, what's gone wrong? That's an amazing argument. That's my kind of best argument. That's the Apple iPhone 6S of apologetic arguments, or the Samsung whatever if you're on the other side, the dark side. Why is this the case? Well, of course, it's all about the importance of communication. And communication isn't just the content. Communication is the way it's transferred. And one of the things, you know, we believe in really, really powerful, really, really deeply at RZDM, I've heard KJ use it with you, I think I may have used it earlier, is this idea that behind every question is a questioner. And I think perhaps the most important thing we can learn as people who want to use apologetics is how do we communicate and engage the questioner, not the question. Because so often, as that last question I think Jesse reminded us of, you know, that people can ask a question, but it's not the question they're asking. It can be a smokescreen. Or people ask one question when the question they really have is another one. I mean, interestingly, that goes on in everyday life as well. Family doctors will tell you that particularly men were fond of this. You know, you go to the doctor and you ask about something obscure, and every doctor goes, okay, you've got a problem in the waterworks department, haven't you? But you're just not going to ask it because you're embarrassed. And I think the same goes true in apologetics. People raise questions that is often not the question they're actually asking. And how do we get behind that as a challenge? Similarly, we're also not addressing disembodied minds, are we? When we're sharing our faith with somebody, we're not talking to a brain on a pair of legs. We're talking to a human being, people with passions and prejudices and hopes and dreams and interests and hearts. And how do we engage those people? And sometimes if we're not careful, we just go for the intellectual part and we miss everything else. And that's a really important thing to think through as we engage our friends. And so what I want to do with you for the next kind of sort of 15 minutes or so is I want to share with you the approach we use at RZAM. That's the heart of all the apologetics that we do. Ravi kind of developed this sort of 35 years ago and sort of built it into the 50 of us on the speaking team. And then I just want to share a couple of lessons from first from Aristotle and then from C.S. Lewis. I want to give you a dead Greek and a dead Brit and what they can teach us about apologetics and some lessons there. And then we'll throw this open for questions, discussion, whatever. So let me talk about the approach we use at RZDM. Though for a moment, what we do when we engage in apologetics in the ministry is we use what we popularly term a three-level approach to apologetics and engaging somebody, whether it's somebody asking a question in a Q&A, whether it's talking to a friend at work or a you know, an old buddy at the coffee shop. Three-level approach, I think, works really well. And it's really simple, actually. The moment you read things like three-level approaches, you probably think it's what's about to come is sort of, you know, dangerously PhD level. But this is brilliantly simple, is what I like about it. And Ravi's kind of field-tested it over 35 years of ministry. And it goes like this. Step one in the three-level approach is to ground your answer intellectually. The intellectual level is important. People need to know that there are reasons why we think the things that we do, that it's not just pie in the sky when you die. It's not all just based on faith. But there are reasons why we believe what we believe. And in particular, one of the ways we like to do this is sort of get into the whole area of how do you test a worldview as true? How do you test a worldview like Christianity or atheism or Buddhism or Hinduism, whatever it is? How do you put a worldview to the test? And we've already found over the years there are kind of sort of three ways you can do that. You can talk about the way what you believe and whether it corresponds to reality. We can talk about that's important for Christians. We can press our atheist friends on this, whatever. How do we test? How do we ensure that what we believe corresponds to reality? We can also look at coherence. Do the things that you believe join up? In fact, I think that's a very powerful test for the Christian worldview. As I was alluding to in that conversation I had with that student in the parking lot that I told you, the fact that as a Christian it's possible to live out the belief that people have real value. That makes sense. But then my atheist friends, they want to tell me that human beings are just atoms and particles, but that also that humans have value and dignity. That's not coherent. Those are two conflicting beliefs. You can't hold those two beliefs simultaneously. We shouldn't be able to. And so coherence is important. And then lastly, livability is a powerful test for a worldview. You know, can you take the beliefs that you say you hold and really live them out in the real world, live them out consistently, and not run into trouble? And that applies, as I say, that's a powerful area where I think many of the competing worldviews to Christianity fall down. One of my good buddies and colleagues on the RZM speaking team is a gentleman called Nabil Qureshi. Some of you may have heard of Nabil, former Muslim, now a Christian, and wrote a New York Times best-selling book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. If you haven't read that book, it's a fantastic read. It's sold something like 200,000 copies, which is quite incredible for a Christian book in this day and age. And he's just written a new book that's literally about to hit the streets in about 2-3 weeks' time, called Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. And I did tease him, actually. That's a great title, because radical Muslims will read that book thinking, a better way to do jihad. That's great. And those of us who are not will go, okay, now this is a different kind of book. Never do that joke again. Anyway, in that book, he talks about this whole area of livability, because he said basically when he was a Muslim, he came across some of the difficult passages in the Quran, some of the violent passages in the Quran. He ran into some of the things that Muhammad got up to and did, particularly in the last portion of his life there in the Muslim texts. And he said, suddenly I realized there was a problem. Because I suddenly realized I had three choices confronting me at this point. One, I could become a radical Muslim. I could become, you know, I could go and fight in Syria or whatever, this was before ISIS. I could go and join Al-Qaeda and live this stuff out. Number two, I could create some postmodern version of Islam of my own invention and just sort of ignore all of this stuff and just build around it, but realize it was just me. Or he said, I could become an apostate and walk away entirely. And he describes how he spent long time wrestling that one through. And basically he was experiencing the livability issue with his Islam as he wanted to take seriously what his texts said, but also found he couldn't live these out in the real world. And that was part of his journey from Islam to Christ. So in ground your answer intellectually, we can talk about the intellectual level with our friends. But then we want to go deeper. The second level of communicating truth, we want to begin trying to move into also the area of the heart as well as the mind. And the power of story comes in well here. And stories are very powerful, particularly stories of your own life, your own walk with Christ, your own struggles, the way that you've wrestled some of these things through. There is nothing like personal testimony for impacting people's lives, particularly if the person you're talking to is wrestling or struggling with something, and as you're listening to them, you think, you know what, I've experienced something like that, or a friend of mine has experienced something like that, has been through that, has wrestled with the question that you've wrestled with, and find ways to illustrate. Because now you're beginning to touch people's heartstrings and connect the emotions into the apologetic as well. One way of doing that too is to read widely in literature, watch movies, you know, watch what your friends are watching, read what your friends are watching. Movies are wonderful resources apologetically, because they tell stories so powerfully and raise all kinds of issues. You know, it amazes me because it's just come around again with a new series of movies coming out. I mean, a movie like Star Wars, for example, if you're a sci-fi fan, I say those are great movies because they raise questions about spirituality. Well, the whole idea of the Force brought into that movie as a Buddhist idea, and we can rail against that, or we can use it to start a conversation about spirituality, and you know, why it is that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Westerners are now describing themselves on forms when it asks for their religion as Jedi. That even cropped up on a national census in the UK a few years ago, that enough people wrote that one down. Again, we can laugh at stupid, college students, or we can go, interesting, and we can use it as a conversation starter. But find ways to use story and illustration, I think, is remarkably powerful. It's harder than learning arguments. Arguments are very easy. Finding stories is harder. But when you look at the greatest apologists, you know, what is it that makes someone like a C.S. Lewis or a G.K. Chesterton, or, you know, I look at what drew me to Ravi, watching him preach. It's the power of stories. Makes a huge impact on people. Or, of course, Jesus. You know, Jesus primarily taught in parables. Why? Because stories are very, very powerful. And then thirdly, so ground your answer intellectually, illustrate your answer existentially. And then thirdly is the importance of demonstrating the answer pragmatically. What do I mean by that? Well, I think people need to see what difference the gospel makes in the real world. People need to understand, okay, this isn't just some idea that you've got, some faith-based thing you've got. What difference does it make? What difference does the gospel make? What difference does Christianity make? If the gospel were true, how would it change my situation? And again, this takes time, and it takes the prompting of the Spirit, and is more of an art, perhaps, than a science. But you can see some powerful breakthroughs in people's lives when you can help them see that. Or, interestingly, when people sometimes work it out for themselves. A friend of mine on the RZDM team, in fact two of us and two of them and me, were doing a dialogue event, a debate rather, at the University of Oklahoma. I was saying rude things about Oklahoma before the break. I need to be more polite now. A couple of years ago, and it was interesting, my colleague was speaking that evening on the uniqueness of Jesus, and we had Q&A, and there were three of us on the stage, and about the fourth question in the Q&A, a young woman comes to the microphone. Dressed from head to toe in black leather and body piercings everywhere. It was almost, you know, bright orange hair. It was quite an amazing kind of picture. I wish I could have, it would have been very rude to have taken a picture, but I wish I had. It was quite impressive look she had going on. Comes the microphone. And she basically asks a question. I forget the exact way she phrased it, but the question was about homosexuality. She raised the gay question. And it was good because I'd answered the question just before. So I nudged Abdu, my colleague, and went, hey, your turn, up you get. And anyway, he did this brilliant answer, gave about 3.5 minute answer to her question. It was very, very clever. So I wish I could remember what it was. It was so brilliant. And now what's interesting, it doesn't end there. So she sat that back down again, moved on. At the end of the evening, she came running up to him at the back of the lecture hall, and in tears, actually, and said, can I talk further to you based upon what you said? And he went, yeah, sure. What's what's going on? And and she said, well, here's the thing. She said, I am a lesbian. I've been in a relationship for a while. I'm not any longer. She said, and, you know, I've been really struggling with this whole issue of sexuality. And she said, I've looked everywhere for answers. I've tried to find answers to my pain and what's going on in me, in atheism and humanism, doesn't work. Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism. She said, you name it, I've tried it. And she said, I've looked a little bit into Christianity, and there's lots in there that's attractive. And in fact, I think the only possible answer to some of the stuff I'm wrestling with lies in this Jesus guy. But she said, I've got so many questions, particularly this one. And and so my friend Abdu looked at her and said, you know, is the homosexuality question, as I guess we put it, is that the only thing keeping you from becoming a Christian? Is that the only objection? And she said, it's not the only one, but it's by far the biggest. It eclipses everything else. And then he looked at her and said, well, you know, I need to tell you this then. You need to hear and you need to understand that we come to Jesus with our brokenness, not in spite of our brokenness, not having sorted our brokenness out. If you've somehow got it into your head that you need to clean up your act in this and other areas before you're acceptable, you've got the whole thing reversed. You come to Jesus with your mess and your chaos and your hang-ups and your screw-ups and everything else and surrender them to him and then let him start the work of dealing with it and healing it. Don't let anyone ever tell you to get yourself cleaned up first. And then he said, you know, and that produced more tears. And then he said, well, could I pray with you? And she went, I'm not quite ready. for that yet. Almost, not quite ready. You can pray for me, she said, not with me. And he did. And I think what's interesting is stories like that tell me that I think there's a deeply pragmatic part of the gospel that attracts many people, as she'd seen, that there was something in the gospel that she sensed could speak to the hurt she had inside. It would make a difference. And that question was just the thing that needed to get dealt with. And at the same time, what Abdu said there, I think, illustrates, I said, a threefold approach. There's actually a fourth point that we like to stress at RZAM, and it's that you always need to get people to the cross. Every apologetic should either start with the cross or end with the cross. And in fact, any apologetic that doesn't, I think, do that in some way probably doesn't deserve the title Christian. And that's sometimes harder than you realize, because it's very easy to have a conversation with somebody that just orbits around in circles at a lovely philosophical level where you talk ideas, but you never connect it to Jesus and to the cross. But the more I've done apologetics and evangelism, the more I've engaged people of all faiths and none, I think the thing that amazes me is on almost every single question we get asked commonly, you can connect that question to Jesus. Some are easier than others. Problem of evil, dead easy. You can get right there. The gay issue, the homosexual question, you can get there. I think every question you can. Some take more practice. But I think as we engage our friends and listen to questions and deal with objections and all of this stuff, to be constantly praying, okay, Lord, how do I start with where my friend is? Be genuine, not baiting and switching them, but demonstrate that the Christian answer to what they're asking ends with Jesus. Because the more we can connect people to him, as KJ said in his introduction, just like clearing away that undergrowth, the more we can show people, hey, see, can you see Jesus from this angle? You see Jesus from this angle? You see Jesus from this angle? And the more a coherent picture of who he is built up. And then we can get the hell out of the way and let Jesus do his work in that person's life. So that's the kind of approach we use to apologetics at RZAM. If there's things that you want me to unpack, I've gone through at fairly high speed, we can do so in the Q&A. But I promised you we're going to talk about a dead Greek and a dead British guy. So I want to talk about Aristotle and C.S. Lewis for the remaining kind of 10 minutes of the talking time. And then we'll open this up for questions. Aristotle, I want to begin with him. Why I think he's important is one of the struggles I think we have as Christians trying to engage our culture today, as we live in a world in which feeling and emotion have largely replaced truth. A few people are nodding. I think we run into that all the time. You know, why is it that Christians, non-Christians, secular friends object to, you know, the evangelical position on gay marriage, for example? It's not because they've thought about it, weighed the arguments, and considered themselves to be true and us to be false. It just feels wrong. It feels the right thing to do to hug and affirm people, you know, no matter what their sexuality, and embrace them. It feels the right thing to do to say, hey, you know, all religions lead to God and not to exclude, and so on and so forth. We live in a world in which feeling is everywhere. And the problem that creates for us is obviously a huge one, of course, because we're people for whom truth matters. We are people for whom the word and scripture matters. And it's never been ever possible to argue anybody to faith. But certainly the postmodern, touchy, feely kind of world we live in certainly means that it gets harder, I think, as Christians. We know you can have that experience of sharing a rational argument for the Christian faith with somebody and them to go, yeah, and just to walk away. Now, obviously, I've shown you how RZAM we try and engage in some of this stuff. But, of course, what's interesting, as somebody who loves philosophy, you know, it was only recently that I stumbled across something entirely obvious, really, which is that actually, although feeling has decided this growth of feelings in our culture is somewhat of a new thing, it's also an old thing. And you can find some of the oldest thinkers and writers we know of who have left their mark on the written record, kind of engaging with this stuff. And Aristotle said some very interesting things about how we present truth and how we engage with people that I think is even more applicable now than it was when he first reflected on it. And I don't know if you're aware of how much sort of reading you've done in the classics, but Aristotle, as well as being a great philosopher, wrote a very famous book on rhetoric, on persuasion. And of course, as Christians, when we share our faith, we're trying to persuade. And he famously identified three aspects to an argument. And I think they're hugely important. Some overlap with what I shared a moment ago, but again, just really helpful, I think, to think about and have in our heads as we try and engage our culture. He said there are three components to an argument. There's the level of logos. That's the intellectual level of an argument. You know, you come to a lecture, You hear a speaker. He gives you an extremely cleverly reasoned out series of arguments, beginning with the fact that Sweden doesn't exist, and demonstrates to you that atheism is in fact a belief system, and you go, that was brilliant. That was incredible. I'm going to go and buy 100 copies of Andy's book for all of my friends. And if subliminal advertising works, my publisher will be very happy. That's Logos. And it's okay, but it has a lot of limits. Has a lot of limits on many levels. Where things get more interesting is when you move down the list. Then Aristotle said, okay, there's Logos, there's the intellectual quality. But now, where we really begin choosing things is the whole question of ethos, for example. You know, what one's friends and peers and the community think. That has a huge effect on us. You know, it's much easier to be a Christian if those around you are Christians. Much harder to be if you're a Presbyterian, for example. And no one got that. And that can be really, 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 really important. I mentioned my friend Abdu, he of the gay discussion earlier. He's an interesting character, one of the newest members of our speaking team. He's also a former Muslim, and he wrote a brilliant book a couple of years ago called Grand Central Question, one of the best books I've seen on apologetics in the last few years. What's really interesting, he begins that book with a story of him trying to share his faith with an older Muslim gentleman, Pakistani gentleman, at a hospital near where Abdu and his family live. And for about 2 hours, they'd gone round and round in circles. Abdu had offered arguments, and this guy had kind of brushed them off, and this guy had asked questions and objections. Abdu had tried to answer them, but hadn't got anywhere. After about 2 hours, suddenly this question popped into his head, and he looked at this Pakistani man lying in the hospital bed and said to him, tell me, sir, I just need to ask you something. If you were to become a Christian today, imagine my next answer was to persuade you, and you were to become a Christian, and leave your Muslim faith. I mean, what would happen next? I mean, would your family throw a party? You'd go home from hospital to see balloons and streamers and chocolate cake. I mean, what would happen if you were to become a Christian? Instantly, the gentleman said, well, if I became a Christian, I'd lose my family. They'd disown me. My daughters would never talk to me again. My wife would probably divorce me. The list went on. And what was interesting, that was a turn in the whole conversation, because it was nothing to do with intellectual arguments. The key thing keeping that man from considering Christ seriously was ethos. The second area here was the family and the community. And asking that kind of question, and I've actually borrowed that question of his now often with Muslim friends, you know, what would happen next if he were to become a Christian? It works with atheists too. Can often reveal how much the person you're talking to is affected by their community, their friends, their peer group. I mean, I often say to people, we need to have sympathy on someone like Richard Dawkins. Can you imagine how could someone like Dawkins even consider faith, given the community he's part of or the reputation? Can you imagine what would happen? What his fellow, all of his, you know, young fans would do if he even said something remotely positive about Christianity? He'd get lynched. How do you create space to even think these things through? I mean, pray for him, and certainly for our Muslim friends. So ethos is important. And then lastly, pathos, the emotional quality of the speaker. You know, you come to a lecture on a Saturday morning, you see a very attractive young speaker with a lovely British accent who's very funny and engaging, and you go, what Andy said, that laughs worry me. and you go back and you go, must be true. And so we've all had this this experience. I mean, politics works. Actually, I always say politics works. Given the current climate, maybe it doesn't work, but maybe just shout at people in a rude voice and people like you. But generally, if we like the speaker, it makes a big difference. And of course, the Apostle Paul talks about this. You know, he says, doesn't he, if I speak in the tongues of men and angels but do not have love, I am a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And what he's saying, in other words, if our character as Christians does not measure up to the words we're using, there's going to be a problem. And so I think we really need to reflect on this really, really hard. And that's one of the reasons, actually, I love the way that apologetics is rooted here in the C.S. Lewis Institute program, because that pours into you as students in terms of discipleship and character and all of these things. And that is certainly the place to, I think, locate apologetics. People need to sort of taste our lives and see there's a difference as well as hear it in our words. But there's a fourth level of influence and persuasion that Aristotle misses from his list that I think is hugely important. And that's the whole power of the imagination. And this is where Lewis is going to come in a moment. The power of the imagination. You know, I said earlier that I had originally been scheduled to do a talk on Thursday night on Can We Life Have Meaning Without God? And I give that talk on university campuses all the time. And I go and I sort of show, using a lot of atheist writers as also then arguing from the Christian perspective that you can't. You can't have meaning and purpose in your life unless God exists. It's just the void. And what's interesting, the last two times I've done that talk at University of Toronto and the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, the same thing has happened. The very first question has been an atheist. In one case, it was the head of the Secular Society in Toronto. Came to the microphone and asked identical questions. And the question was basically this. It went, Andy, that was a very persuasive talk. In fact, you've persuaded me. I agree that life can't have meaning without God, that it's just grim despair. I think tragically you're right. But that does not prove Christianity is true. And I love that question, because in both times I answered it the same way. And when you are absolutely categorically right, and this talk today was not designed to convince you that Christianity was true, it was designed to show you that atheism leads to despair, and Christianity is a powerful solution to that. The very fact you've run so quickly to the microphone at the end tells me you're attracted to that idea. There's a note of despair in your question. In other words, there's something about Christianity that's now attractive. Over here, there is meaning and purpose and identity and value. There is none over here. This looks attractive. I just don't have coherent reasons for beginning it yet. And I always end up by saying, you now need to talk to some of my friends in the campus ministries who can meet with you and share with you some of the reasons. But now you're looking in like the kid with his nose pressed to the candy store window going, that looks quite nice in there. And Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, once observed, he said, you know, our task in evangelism is first to present the gospel in such a way that good people wish that it were true and then show that it is. And I often wonder how our evangelism might look if we orientated it that way. How do we help our atheist friends, our skeptical friends, our Muslim friends imagine what the Christian world might look like, what it would be like if it were true that it's not all about voting Republican and having the right set of morals and not drinking and not dancing and not going to the movies and, you know, all of those things as Baptists we were told not to do and so forth. There's obviously a lot of Baptists here, no one's laughing. And laughing is definitely not godly, but there we go. So how do we do it? How do we engage the imagination? Well, this is where C.S. Lewis comes in. Because Lewis, of course, loved the power of story in particular. And as he put it, through stories we can tiptoe past the watchful dragons that often guard the front door of people's minds, and we can get through the side door. People who are resistant to truth claims, who are resistant to logical arguments, well, we can use imagination and story to sow truth. Let me read you actually what Lewis said about why he wrote the Narnia books. He said, I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings. And reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if it were something medical. But supposing that by casting all of these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. And actually, it was that quotation of Lewis there that inspired me to write The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, because I was wrestling with how could I write an apologetics book that atheists might actually want to read. There's been so many good Christian books of arguments written, atheists never read them. And I thought, gosh, story's powerful. And I thought, yeah, trouble is I can't write story for Toffee. But people do tell me I can be a little bit funny. And so that was why what I've tried to do in that book is use comedy the way that Lewis uses story. In this case, not so much as to steal past the watchful dragon, as to tickle the watchful dragon under its nose, and when it's rolling on its back laughing, run through the front door anyway. But famously, to return to Lewis, famously where Lewis played with story, of course, is the Chronicles of Narnia. And every one of us here is probably familiar with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I suspect some of you have even been to the Wade Center at Wheaton College, and like Muslims visiting Mecca, you have stroked carefully the wood of that wardrobe there. And if you're like me, you've waited till the person on duty is looking the other way and you've actually climbed inside it. Do not tweet that, please. Some of you, I'm sure you've done that. Everyone does that. Anyway, That story, of course, everyone loves it. It's a very powerful one. You know, Lewis uses the death of Aslan to represent the death of Christ, so forth and so on and so forth. But I often think actually some of Lewis's most interesting use of this occurs outside of that book. We know that book too well. My actual favorite passage in the whole of the seven Chronicles of Narnia, where Lewis uses imagination just to play with apologetics. It's only a tiny little passage, but I think my all-time favorite of his Narnia, his bits in Narnia, comes in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And it's an incredible, incredible book, wrecked by the movie, but there we go, that's another polemic for another time. And in the 13th chapter of that book, if you've read it, in the 13th chapter of the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, our heroes come to a place called the Island of the World's End. And on the Island of the World's End, they meet a mysterious old man called Ramandu. I want to read you a couple of paragraphs from there. Did I put it on the screen or not? No, I didn't. Just a blank screen, so I'll just read it to you. That's my note to go. Passage too long for screen. Read. Okay, so I'll read you this passage from Voyage of the Dawn Treader. "I am Ramandu," said the old man, "but I see that you stare at one another and have not heard this name. And no wonder, for the days when I was a star had ceased long before you knew this world, and all the constellations have changed." "Golly," said Edmund under his breath. That's the way everyone speaks in England, by the way. "Golly," said Edmund under his breath. "He's a retired star." "Aren't you a star any longer?" asked Lucy. "I'm a star at rest, my daughter," answered Ramandu. "When I set out for the last time, decrepit and old beyond all that you can reckon, I was carried to this island. I'm not so old now as I was then. Every morning a bird brings me a fireberry from the valleys and the sun, and each fireberry takes away a little of my age. And when I have become as young as the child that was born yesterday, then I shall take my rising again, for we are at the earth's eastern rim, and once more I shall tread the great distance." "In our world," said Eustace, "a star is a huge ball of flaming gas." "Even in your world, my son," said Ramandu, "that is not what a star is, but is only what it is made of." And I love that passage. Even as a kid, I got the key idea in that passage. Lewis stitches this incredible truth into that little bit of narrative. Something is not defined by what it is. And there you have the heart of the difference between the Christian worldview and the atheist worldview. So human beings are made of atoms and dust. The question is that what a human being is? And of course, for Christians, no. Now, you try explaining that idea to someone through philosophical argument. You try explaining that to a kid through philosophical argument. I have a 3-year-old who's begun asking philosophical questions. The other day, my wife texted me to say, "Katrina has just come up and asked me, 'Mummy, is Jesus his own daddy?' Because Jesus is the Son of God, and Jesus is God, so therefore is he his own father?" And she was like, "When you get home, you can answer this one. You are the theologian." And the challenge is answering it in 10 seconds before the next question, which was about Hello Kitty. But, you know, there we are. You try explaining that idea, that something is more than what it is, not the same as what it is, to somebody who's not philosophical or to a young person. But inject it into a story. Tell a story like Lewis does, and it's incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. The imagination can be this amazing vehicle for conveying truth about the gospel in a way that even a child can grasp. It was interesting, a year and a half ago, I remember talking with a philosophy professor at the University of Alberta up in Edmonton in Canada, staunch atheist, been an atheist for 50 years, and emeritus professor of philosophy there. And as we talked, you know, he began sharing, he was very honest actually, about the struggles he had to fit his hopes and his dreams and his desires, especially for justice, into an atheist framework. He was really honest about that tension. And as I listened to Don, you know, I found myself coming back to some of this stuff about Lewis, and I sort of found myself thinking, you know, the trouble is, and I think I said this to him, you know, it sounds to me, Don, like what you're saying is that the story that you're living in can't accommodate the rest of your beliefs. You're living in this atheist story, and it's not big enough for the things that you hold to be true. And actually, I said that's precisely what happened to one of my heroes, C.S. Lewis, who, funnily enough, he didn't really know, so I'm hoping he'd gone off and read him now, but there we are. Who was largely, of course, Lewis largely led to Christ through the imagination. And in fact, in Surprised by Joy that I quoted to you earlier from another passage there, Lewis writes this. He says, in reading G.K. Chesterton, as in reading George MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful about his reading. And so really, what I've hoped I've done over the last 25 minutes or so, or half an hour, is just given you a window into different ways we can engage in apologetics. Use the mind, absolutely. Engage on the level of the heart, crucial. Demonstrate to people the difference the gospel makes. What the difference does it make to be a Christian if the gospel is true? And then lastly, the piece that is so often missed in the contemporary church, and the piece that Lewis got so right, and why I think he's this great hero of apologetics, is the imagination. Because that's where things get really, really powerful. Lewis used it, we can learn to use it, and of course Jesus used it in the parables and in the Gospels and the way that he shared with people who he was. So let's pray that as we do that and pull those four threads together, the Lord can use us to make an impact and a difference in the lives of our friends and our colleagues, our family members and those we care dearly about.